All right, so Lucas and I are here today. We are on the final chapter of Soft War, a novel theory on power projection and the national strategic significance of Bitcoin. It has been an intellectual odyssey. I hope you've joined us. We've went through the previous five chapters, and it's all cumulative to, of course, the recommendations and conclusions that we get today. We'll do a little summary here, and then we're going to go through the recommendations and conclusions, rather the recommendations one by one, and parse them out. So the core argument of this thesis, I've kind of stated it this way in the past, is something like Bitcoin represents a soft, as in non-kinetic, non-lethal form of warfare that could be used to counteract the dysfunctions of abstract power hierarchies emerging in digital age society. So that's an important thing. The abstract power-based hierarchies, these can be nation states, software-based corporations like Google or Facebook. And the nature of an abstract power hierarchy, or the nature of abstract power rather, is that it is imaginary. It's based on the designation of rank or authority within a belief system, like politicians, judges, priests, software admins. They determine by designation, they're designated the authority to determine who gets access to resources or rights within the system. The admin is the one who kind of divvies out access to the digital resources within a piece of software, and a judge does it perhaps within democratic society, adjudicating rival claims. In the past, so the nature of an abstract power-based hierarchy was that the power was imaginary. It was an imaginary form of power. Alongside that, we also have, of course, physical power. We have armies, we have wars, we have revolutions, we have the actual exercise of kinetic or lethal physical power that's projected. So this, to do a quick run through up to chapter five, then that was kind of a statement of the core thesis and what an abstract power-based hierarchy is and what physical power is. This whole endeavor begins in chapter two. We went through the methodology as grounded theory analysis, which is a way of doing a qualitative form of analysis. So it's not just quantitative, kind of technically parsing what Bitcoin is, but it's qualitative. It's looking at what the implications might be. In grounded theory methodology, you don't begin with a hypothesis. Instead, you set out with a sort of general idea that you're going to create a theoretical framework from which later hypotheses can be deducted and then analyzed. The grounded theory methodology, and we saw this as we explored the book, it requires a sort of like indiscriminate, broad-based investigation, a sort of courage to really go outside of one's kind of professional domain and explore and refine your explorations as you move along, hoping that everything is going to coalesce into a final theory. That theory for Lowry's work here is power projection theory. So chapters 3, 4, and 5 are developments of power projection theory, first in nature, then in human society, then within cyberspace, within human society. So in chapter 3, power projection tactics in nature. I mean, we learned that power projection is used by animals as a way to delineate claims to resources. Power literally in watts, the ability to, in the real world, exercise power. So in order to control resources, you have to kind of beat off the rival claimants, ward them off. And so that is a form of, requires a form of physical power projection. We got an evolutionary account that led up to pack animals evolving, where cooperation was a form of physical power projection they used in order to compete with other animals. Wolves travel in packs because that's more powerful when they're getting resources from other animals in the environment. But it also leads to this issue where you then have to divide resources intra-species, intra-pack. You have to have a dominance hierarchy in order to determine who is going to, within the wolf pack, get certain resources. Within nature, these dominance hierarchies, intra-species, intra-pack, are based on power projection. There are kind of, the wolves will scrabble, they'll snarl at each other, but they'll usually stop short of killing. They dominate and then they back away. We saw with deer, they actually develop an apparatus for physical power projection in a non-injurious form, in the form of antlers, so that they can have these jousting competitions in a way that's not so prone to injury. Yet still, again, they're projecting physical power to determine amongst them who is going to get feeding and breeding rights, which led to the systemic benefit of the pack, because it would tend to, in the long term, lead to a more fit pack. From there, we moved on to chapter 4, Power Projection Tactics in Human Society, as a continuum, again, evolutionarily from where we are just animals. And so the evolutionary story is where we depart as well. We also, though, as humans, developed the capacity for abstract thought, a way to be better hunters. We actually became the apex predator because we developed a theory of mind and could imagine what other species were thinking or how they might act. And so we could then better kind of develop our hunting strategies to take down the bison as we cooperated in a group with other humans. We're pack animals too, humans are. We began to cooperate, and we scaled up our cooperation beyond what most animals can really do, because our power for abstract thought allowed us to develop belief systems. People could then, you didn't have to formally know somebody or know their name or have them be family in order to know that you can trust them in a certain sense as part of a cooperative endeavor. Instead, you can just say, that person's part of my tribe, that person's part of my clan, that person's part of my religion. You could have a belief system where you all could subscribe to. That belief system could scale up cooperation, and we get the flowering of these, you know, bigger and bigger human cooperative packs. These belief systems were interesting because they were abstract, and they gave rise to a new form of power, of abstract power, to settle intra-species dominance hierarchies, to establish a pecking order, to determine who would get the rights within the tribe, clan, or group. These belief systems, again, I mentioned earlier, we would designate a chief, a politician, a judge, a priest, maybe a shaman really early on, in order to tell a story about who got what and for what reason. The issue with this, and this gets us to an important aspect of the theory, is that abstract power hierarchies come with kind of some built-in dysfunctions. I mentioned earlier that hierarchies, dominance hierarchies based on physical power projection, led to these systemic benefits of selecting for the strongest, the most intelligent, allocating breeding and feeding rights to them. And so long term, you get a more agile, adroit, and more lethal pack, lethal, at least more evolutionarily fit. With an abstract power hierarchy, you're no longer meritocratically selecting for the projection of power. Instead, again, it's a belief system that is kind of abstractly determining who gets these feeding and breeding rights. And so people then tend to become self-domesticated. We are averse to physical confrontation. We have a theory of mind. We don't want to see our brothers and sisters suffer. And so if there's an abstract belief system that's kind of giving us a class, a role, a story about what our rights are, we tend to accept those and self-domesticate rather than stand up for ourselves in a sense and fight for more rights. So abstract power hierarchies, I mentioned they come with these kind of inbuilt dysfunctions of kind of a weakness towards external predation. They're not meritocratic. So the whole group can become weaker and become subject to invasion from the outside. Also, there can emerge a ruling class that exploits and abuses this kind of predatory systemic predators over the group itself, the people at the top of the hierarchy, leads to oppression, which can lead to an uprising, a revolution from within. So in these two ways, both the invasion from without that kind of devours a weak abstract power hierarchy, or the revolution from within that, again, arises to resist the oppression based purely on imaginary power of a ruling class. Both of these are projections of physical power that is remedying the dysfunction of an abstract power hierarchy. Abstract power hierarchies, though, even though we have physical power kind of fine-tuning them, they don't disappear. In fact, they continue to scale up our cooperation. And we get into, you know, from clans to city states to nation states. What physical power does do, though, is over time, at least has the tendency to move from, for example, monarchy to democracy, these revolutions, these periodic revolutions to remove oppressive abstract power hierarchies, again, can remedy the dysfunction a bit because they can at least discipline these continually scaling abstract power hierarchies, because the ruled have to maintain a bit of fear of those that they rule over, because they know the story of history of how many kings were eaten by the people that they were predatory over. So that leads us to chapter 5, power projection tactics in cyberspace. Basically, abstract power-based hierarchies are based on a belief system that is told, that is created, a story that is told that people then subscribe to and kind of opt in to believe and agree to their role within it. Software then in the digital age is a digital form of a belief system. It's a set of encoded permissions, like a rule of law that determines rank, who gets what digital resource, for those who kind of opt into the software, who download it, such as, you know, if you join something like Facebook or Google, you're at the mercy of that belief system. You both operate according to its rules within it, and also your account can be shuttered if you don't follow the rules, essentially. The admin of the software is a sort of Theronic god king. Like in the past, they have absolute control. And not only that, but we know that they collect our personal data, which then in kind of very insidious and extensive ways that can be used to surveil, influence, control, or cancel a person. This is all abstract power. Again, this is not physical power that these hierarchies, these abstract power-based software hierarchies are using on people, the surveillance, the control, the canceling of a person, the deleting of their account. This is all imaginary power for those that opt into the software. In the past, physical power would have been used to kind of curtail these excesses if a piece of software becomes too oppressive and begins to delete the accounts of people that aren't towing a certain line. But how do you project physical power against a piece of software? How do you use what in the past has been the literal projection of physical force, a war, an invasion, a violent revolution? How do you do that against software? We have degenerating and increasingly oppressive abstract power-based hierarchies in the digital age, in cyberspace, but seemingly no way to discipline them through the use of physical power. They're becoming transnational. They're becoming bigger than nation states. It also seems like we do have ways to use physical power, of course, but these ways aren't usable directly in cyberspace. And when you use them, the forms of kinetic warfare that we have are quickly scaling out of practical use. We've arrived at the point where we now have strategic nuclear arms that, again, it's mutually assured destruction if someone pulls the trigger on using them. So we've arrived at these like kinetic ceilings where the use of physical real world force over land, sea, or air seems kind of existentially risky. So how do we do this again in cyberspace? How do we project physical power so as to curtail oppressive abstract power hierarchies? Arrive Bitcoin, or more specifically, the proof of work aspect of the Bitcoin protocol. This is a piece of technology that makes information bits physically costly. It initiates a competition for admin rights through the expenditure of real-world physical power. Everyone can participate in the protocol in a zero-trust, permissionless, egalitarian manner. There's no god king that sits over it. It, in fact, according to Lowry, is a new, maybe a new form of warfare he calls soft war, a play on software. Soft war being the ability through the proof-of-work protocol to project physical power non-kinetically into cyberspace in a way that's infinitely scalable. Unlike the nuclear stalemate, we can continue adding hash rate, continue feeding energy into the proof of work aspect of the protocol. It's also weirdly cooperative in that both our enemies and our friends were all using the same protocol. So this, again, is kind of the overarching thesis, is that soft war may be a novel form of warfare that we can use physical power in cyberspace, and it may have, through the proof of work protocol, kind of other emergent benefits for society. This brings us to chapter 6, which we're going to talk about in detail today. Chapter 6 kind of has three parts. There's the first part's the key takeaways, some of the key takeaways. There's so many takeaways, of course, from such a thoroughly grounded and deep book. But the key takeaways in Lowry's estimation, followed by a set of explicit recommendations And then concluding the whole chapter with kind of closing thoughts. So we'll go through, first I'll just do a quick summary of the key takeaways, and then the closing thoughts, they're kind of similar. And then Lucas and I'll hash out the different recommendations and go through each one individually. So the key takeaways, as I read Lowry's, this chapter, Lowry's statement of what the key takeaways were, is that first, Bitcoin is a physical security network that is named after its first widely adopted use case. So this is a point he emphasizes throughout the book. We call it Bitcoin, but that's kind of just because Satoshi Nakamoto, the pseudonymous author of the white paper, the person who launched the protocol, of course, he described it as a, he named it Bitcoin, described these units as coins, and kind of therefore we come upon it now as Bitcoin with seemingly a purpose already built into the metaphor we use to describe it as a monetary protocol. And so Lowry wants us to kind of see it with new eyes, get past this blinding metaphor. And one of the ways he really does this is to kind of point out that proof of work precedes Bitcoin as a, there's a proof of work as a cybersecurity piece of technology has a history that is, goes back to 1993, goes further back than Bitcoin as a monetary protocol. Another insight is, as Lowry says, he says that a goal of the thesis was to highlight the 21st century vulnerability to centrally controlled computer networks and centrally controlled software. As we talked about, these are abstract power-based hierarchies, and these types of and historically for humans, abstract power-based hierarchies have broken down and been the subject of war and revolution. So Lowry is saying that we really need a way to defend against these in the digital realm, and we can do that then through perhaps converting a globally distributed power grid into a planetary scale computer that uses proof of work to allow power projection into cyberspace. He also talks about another key insight from his thesis is that war and revolution, they do have emergent benefits. We all see the terror and the horror of war, the cost in blood, the fratricide, but Lowry really wants to reorient us to, hey, we can't ignore that historically war and revolution have had benefits. They have curtailed oppressive abstract power hierarchies and prevented their expansion and control over all of the centralizing of power over too many resources. So war has at least tended to decentralize power and make it less oppressive. Another really interesting point he mentions here is that historically, physical confrontation, really, if you kind of look at history, when we've had physical confrontation, that was preceded by an abstract power-based hierarchy that became too abusive or oppressive. So when there are these oppressive hierarchies, physical confrontation tends to reemerge in the form of a new war. And so Bitcoin, too, we should see the emergence of that in its historical contingency as a form of physical resistance against, at the time, an abstract power-based hierarchy. Bitcoin is already a revolution. It's already a form of resistance, even though we've been calling it money. Whatever it was the response to what was already an exploitative financial system and a predatory abstract-based power hierarchy in the digital realm. Another key insight for Lowry is that Bitcoin is reverse optimized, which is just to say usually computers and computer programming is done so that information bits become less and less costly. Computer chips get smaller and smaller, quicker and quicker, and each individual byte becomes less energy intensive, each individual bit. Bitcoin is the opposite way. The proof of work protocol is all about making it more costly to operate, making each of the bits more costly. This is a good response, by the way, to someone who makes an environmental argument against Bitcoin. One of those responses could be that the fact that Bitcoin is energy intensive is a feature, not a bug. It's like antlers. Again, antlers might seem to be kind of pointless or ornamental, a use of energy that's not needed. It might seem to be better if a deer just had a single horn out of its head to ward off predators, but we know that there are complex emergent benefits to having this branching structure on its head because it can do these jousting competitions, intraspecies, in a way that reduces harm to those that participate in the jousting protocol. Another complex emergent benefit of making cyberspace more costly, a key insight from Lowry, is that it makes cyberspace more real, more scarce, and decentralized. The changing nature, another insight, is that the changing nature of technology means that the forms of power projection are going to change. We have the development of computers and code, and when you look at human history, you have vast expanses where, of course, there wasn't writing, and so there was just, you know, spoken language and warfare. Then we got to a shorter period where written writing is developed, and there's still, even though data enables abstract power-based hierarchies to scale and spread quicker, there's still war available to discipline and break and decentralize them. Now we have computers and code, an even shorter amount of time, abstract power-based hierarchies can scale even quicker. And yet, seemingly, we don't have the way to discipline and decentralize these transnational communities that are creating policies written in computer language. And so, given that, what now? How to project power in the information age? To quote Lowry on a key insight, he says, "The key insight of power projection theory can be summarized in two sentences. Technology, like Bitcoin, could represent the discovery of an unprecedented power projection tactic, which gives people a new way to establish their dominance hierarchies and physically secure the properties and policies they value. This technology has the potential to disrupt human polities," a polity being like a society and its physical and its form of governance. "This technology has the potential to disrupt human polities at their very foundation by changing the way our species manages one of its most precious resources, information itself, and all of the knowledge and abstract power derived from it." So this destabilization of disruption of human polities, we might call a strangler pattern. This is another insight from Lowry. So the strangler pattern, the strangler fig tree, is a type of plant that grows around an existing tree and eventually kind of kills it and replaces the tree altogether. It's a sort of progressive envelopment where it's not all at once. And it's actually also a concept in computer science where it's a software design strategy where you kind of gradually replace a legacy system with a new one and kind of migrate services over piecemeal instead of doing it all at once. That's the strangler pattern. You're strangling slowly by leaching functionality into a new system. So the thought is that Bitcoin could be that for the internet. Its disruption of a human polity could be that it becomes a new backbone or architecture for the internet that operates as a strangler vine, leeches functionality from the internet, from cyberspace, migrating services. First, the financial service migrates, perhaps. Then after that, things like free speech and you know, anything else that can be valuable information, which perhaps could be anything, which leads us to a final insight, again, that I think really shows the breadth of the thesis, but also the stark implications of what Bitcoin is. The final insight is this is about reorganizing not just cyberspace, but society itself. So to quote Lowry, "This technology isn't just disruptive to monetary systems, it's disruptive to how our species answers the existentially important question of managing its resources. Proof-of-work technologies like Bitcoin could change the dynamics of 10,000 years worth of physical power competitions, consequently disrupting how societies organize themselves and shifting the global balance of power." And so just to zoom in on that line, disrupting how societies organize themselves, Lowry says later, quote, "With the global adoption of cyberspace, combined with the global adoption of an electro-cyber form of physical power competition enabled by proof-of-work technologies like Bitcoin, humanity could be at the dawn of creating a completely new type of polity that it has never seen before, a new or adjusted type of governance system which enables the formation of an organized society that resembles something on par with, or perhaps even superior to, a traditional government. With the emergence of cyberspace and a new way to project power in, from, and through cyberspace, humanity could be crossing the event horizon of a highly impactful discovery akin to the discovery of agriculture. These technologies could reshape our understanding of what the term national defense means by changing what national means, because this technology could change how abstract power hierarchies are formed in the first place. I just want to highlight how remarkable that is. The idea that it could change what national defense is, because it's changing the whole idea of what it means to be a nation. The nation used to be what secured for us all of our property rights, but what does it mean when a decentralized, zero trust, permissionless protocol that anybody can subscribe to is what begins to secure those property rights, not the nation state? So the next parts of recommendations, I'll skip over that and then we'll circle back. The closing thoughts is that Lowry's closing thoughts is that first, Bitcoin is about balance of power, not about money. That should be obvious again from the strangler pattern where it becomes this new architecture and disrupts society. It's about taking control over precious resource bits and out of the hands of people with imaginary power, which can be both nation states and also God, king, software administrators of transnational communities based in software. Another closing thought, and this is good if one ever becomes skeptical of certain aspects of this theory, is that humans are apex predators. And so if you think we can have an abstract power-based hierarchy, you're both ignoring the extent without any sort of way to discipline or control it through power, you're ignoring the extensive history of the kind of revolution against these types of hierarchies, and also just the evolutionary fact that we are apex predators, that we will continue to exploit belief systems unless some people physically constrain those who would abuse or those who would abuse those systems. Programmers creating belief systems regarding some of our most precious resources right now are consolidating power, leading to classes of kind of a technocratic god king whose abstract power is derived from the software we use. Again, these are apex predators. People are not to blame. They're simply going to do this. And so to be real, we need to acknowledge that and acknowledge that physical power needs to be projected. And again, in the cyberspace, Bitcoin seems to be the way that this might happen. He briefly touches on the game theory, very briefly, of this, stating that what are you going to do with Bitcoin then? You can't ignore it. You can't stop other people from using it. So third option, you embrace it or you suffer what others do and you don't. And he concludes with his kind of the metaphor that summarizes a key aspect of his view, is that which is that Bitcoin is antlers. It's a way to settle dominance hierarchies over our valuable resources using a globally adoptable, it's available to everybody around the world, non-lethal because non-kinetic, physical power projection technology that reaches into the virtual. It's not just a technological breakthrough, he says, but an evolutionary breakthrough. There's another good quote, so I want to read it here. This is towards the conclusion of the conclusion. Quote, if we could figure out a way to set up our dominance hierarchies over our valuable resources using a globally adoptable, non-lethal physical power projection technology that would not just represent a technological breakthrough that could change the nature of war fighting, that would be an evolutionary breakthrough. It would represent the evolution of a technology that would literally empower humans to establish intra-species dominance hierarchies and determine the right balance of power dynamics using non-lethal electric physical power rather than kinetic physical power, all while still retaining the complex emergent benefits of physical power-based resource control structures. And so he has a quote from Robert Breedlove that I think embodies this really well. The quote is, innovation is non-biological evolution. Evolution is biological innovation. They're the same process, just different substrates. So in the digital age, in cyberspace, perhaps our evolution continues with the innovation that is Bitcoin as a new form of evolution in the substrate that is cyberspace. That's a summary of the first and the third part of the last chapter, the key insights and the closing thoughts. So before we jump into the recommendations portion, that's a lot, Lucas. I mean, he definitely doesn't shy away from grand conclusions. what did you take from that?
Well, first off, happy opening day of deer season, by the way.
Get yourself some antlers.
Very fitting that we're having this conversation today. So let me give my quick summary. So we've got this guy whose job is to determine how the next war is going to be fought, with the knowledge that no war is ever fought the same as the one before it. Kind of the coolest job ever, but also kind of terrifying, because you're literally trying to think of, you've watched this progression. Or sorry, let me not comment on that and then just move on. So, because I'll get there. So he's got this job and he's supposed to figure out how the next war is fought. And then he goes, well, in order to figure this out, because we've not been very successful at predicting how the next war would be fought, because we have not been very successful at recognizing the technology that already existed, and being able to assign it as a weapon instead of whatever purpose it was being used for upon invention. The airplane being a fun example, black powder being a fun example. They treated people with indigestion with black powder, and didn't use it for a couple hundred years as a power projection source. So he says, instead of trying to just ask the question, what I'm going to do is I'm going to use this grounded theory methodology, and I'm going to basically zoom out and squint a little bit, and I'm going to start literally, in true, fully comprehensive fashion, I'm going to start literally with single-celled organisms, and I'm then going to walk forward through time, and I'm going to see if there are patterns that emerge. And it turns out that the pattern emerges that all organisms, plants, animals, amoebas, single cell, like all organisms do the same thing. They project power in an active or a passive fashion that secures their resources and the access to them. And they do so with increasing amounts of power until a stalemate is met. And when a stalemate is met, in nature, you have balance. You have the natural order of things. So once you get out of nature and you get into humans, then you've got this capability for imagination. And with this ability for long-term thought and planning, then we have the ability to then move past the stalemate by innovating a new type of power projection. Like a deer, if it were to do the same thing that humans did, is it would have antlers and then it would go back to the shop and it would come back with AKs strapped to antlers. And then it would murder everything except one would get away and that one would go to the shop and it would come back with, flamethrowers and missiles and heat-seeking stuff strapped to its antlers, and it would just accelerate. That is what humans have done, is that we did the same sort of power projection that is seen in nature. And then when it got to the point that we developed consciousness and long-term planning, we took it to a new level where we started to break out of the natural order of things and enter into this increasing arms race of being able to project more power. And each time there's a stalemate, I think this is a really important comment or thought. Each time there's a stalemate, you have peace. And that's really interesting to me. And the reason that's interesting to me is that that reveals that war is not fought over ideologies. War is fought over resources, because if the ideology was the thing, you would just... So if the ideology was the thing, then if you got the new technology first, you would obliterate everybody that you could with it and keep doing it and never stop.
Yeah.
Without regard for the resources. But when you enter into the stalemate, what we see is peace. And so that, to me, says that really what is happening is that we are fighting over resources at the top level, but then sold a story in order to sell the belief of why. Because we have to have the enemy. We have to, you know, and that's what propaganda has always been, which is you're trying to make the opposition subhuman in the way that they appear so that you can hate them, so that you can fight them. But the decisions being made at the top, the people sending people to die, they're fighting over resources. But they're fighting over resources in order to use the power of the resources to strengthen their abstract power-based hierarchy. And this was a really interesting revelation, I think, which was that in the race for Bitcoin, it can happen very, very fast. And speed is a trait of dictatorships and kings and monarchs. If you have only one person at the top with a lot of power, they have the benefit of being able to move very quickly. And that benefit's also a drawback, because they can also oppress very quickly.
Yeah.
But so the United States is, in terms of its decision-making apparatus, is really behind the eight ball, because we were designed to be slow in acting so that we would be slow in making mistakes, which is arguably a really good method. If you only try not to screw things up, then that is usually a good way to preserve something. So as long as you're starting with something good, and you just say, this is good, we're not going to mess it up, and you design your system that way, I think that makes sense. So you can't really fault it. But anyways, we're definitely behind the eight ball. The difference here is that in adopting this new technology, I likened it to the race for the nuclear bomb. Both sides knew that they had to get to the same destination. Both sides were putting resources towards getting to the new destination. The one that got it first used it immediately, and then it's never been used since. And the reason being was that during the peace that came right after, you know, you created this stalemate again, and so you've got somewhat type of peace. Of course, then we have the development of proxy wars and stuff. But anyways, the point to be made is that there is, at the base level, to the people who are sold the story that they go to war, that is selling ideology. That's propaganda. At the top level, where the decisions are made, it is a battle over resources. But it's a battle over resources to enforce that specific type of power hierarchy.
Right.
And therefore, I think that is where I really understand how adamant and urgent and loud Jason is trying to be on this subject, because it's not going to be a stalemate. So when both sides have bombs, they have a stalemate, because they're so efficient at what they do, they're too inefficient to use. But with Bitcoin, it's not. This was my kind of idea from chapter one or two, I can't remember, but dead money kills. In the same way, you've got all this potential energy, all these warheads that are built up, and in order to impart power, they have to be released. The difference with Bitcoin is that it's not dead, it's alive. So instead of reaching a natural plateau of a stalemate, if you're the last one to jump on board to Bitcoin, then you just get your ass kicked for 1,000 years every second of the day for eternity. And the only way that you can change that balance of power is to exert, or is to do something that is valuable higher up higher up the road, you know, to literally outcompete. And this is, you know, so this is, he comments on how this rearranges society. And the way that I have thought about how it rearranges society, from a corporate standpoint, from a business standpoint, is that if you no longer have to overcome the cost of capital being a 12% loss because of inflation, then you are no longer tied to growth. Growth is just consumption. So what we're doing is we're iterating on a current process in order to just try and get more out of it. And growth for growth's sake is not good. It misallocates capital because it is continuously trying to make a faster horse, not invent the car. And so if we adopt this, then we'll see corporations that their goal, instead of becoming a quarterly goal of I need to grow 3% this quarter, it will become like Michael Saylor's company, a 1,000-year goal. Don't lose the Bitcoin. This is your goal. Your goal is to have this strategic reserve of this very powerful highest order of property, the only thing that you can actually own, which means that you have to give it away. It can't be taken from you. So the premise changes from instead of outcompete next week, next month, next year, it's compete against yourself to not die. It's interesting because that falls into, you see Brian Johnson, Don't Die on X a lot now, who's real good friends with Balaji, who is a big time Bitcoin dude. So interesting thoughts in there.
Yeah.
I just think that's kind of fascinating to think about, which is that mutually assured destruction is proof that we fight for resources, not beliefs, but it's resources to enforce the beliefs. We're in a position where if this is the case, then it's already been adopted. We're already kind of fairly late in the game in terms of recognizing it, because the actual innovation was proof of work. So 1993, 1996 era or whatever, proof of work is the black powder that was ignored. And Bitcoin is the cannon and the cannonball that when you put that together, then you're able to do something that shatters the opposition, I think. So
yeah.
Anyways, I'll leave it.
Bitcoin as a Manhattan Project is interesting because, in a sense, what has happened is the bomb has already went off and we are all facing away from the light, looking at our shadows, wondering what's going on, seeing our shadows get longer and longer, seeing the world change around us. It's like proof of work was the Manhattan Project. It was done in relative obscurity by computer scientists. It was then a series of nuclear bombs were set off by Adam Back and Hal Finney testing it, and then Satoshi Nakamoto successfully has what do you call that? What's that one in Oppenheimer, the final test where it's a success? There's a name for it.
I know what you're talking about, but I don't know the name either. Yeah,
I don't either. But in any case, like that was the absolute test of it, the realization of it. So the bomb was already went off. The Manhattan Project concluded in 2009, and now it's just, can we recognize that the world has changed? Can we recognize? I mean, Paul Revere is already late. Like the revolution is already ongoing at this point. It's just, will we even realize that there's already a war being fought? I mean, if Bitcoin is bit power, the protocol is already operating. And again, historically, if physical power is projected as the result of an abstract power-based hierarchy, then Bitcoin was already the shot across the bow. Bitcoin was already the projection of physical power. I mean, we already had an oppressive abstract power-based hierarchy that we all felt, that we all feel, which is the financial system. Whether for you was the subprime mortgage crisis, whether it was Occupy Wall Street, this was percolating, whether it is in other countries, the fact that the United States has the global reserve currency and can leverage it to export inflation abroad. All of these things were already the abstract power-based hierarchy of fiat currency with all of its oppressive aspects. The war then began with Bitcoin. It's already bit power. It's already operating. The war is fighting. Again, it's just, will the United States realize that it is already the participant in a war that's being fought? And this is the cool part about it is, you know, you can go ahead and pick up arms in this war. And this war can be about not just the nation state versus other nation states, but the individual against, again, the God King of software, against other nation states. This is a neutral, permissionless protocol. We can all begin to build up the army, so to speak, and represent, at the end of the day, the ideology we hope to be the dominant one that emerges from once Bitcoin has, like acid, eaten through the abstract power-based hierarchy that it is operating against. Whatever reemerges from that, again, strangler pattern, hopefully, if the good and the righteous have got Bitcoin, then, I mean, maybe there's never good and righteous. We're all apex predators. But the thought is, you know, if we believe abstract power, it can also be a good thing, right? We all have beliefs, and we want our beliefs at the end of the day to win. And that's why Lowry is, I mean, he's theorizing this because he's a military officer. I mean, he wants the United States to win, I suppose. And he wants the ideology, the abstract power that it represents, to emerge victorious at the end of the day, rather than a communist vision, an anarcho tyrannical vision, whatever other vision. And so, again, I think that for me, like, the last chapter really gelled that insight that, oh my gosh, the war is already being fought. We're already participants. And so, like, if you understand that, then you are historically in quite the position as an individual. And we shouldn't take that lightly. Both, I mean, people like Lowry, who want to sound the horn to the institutions that he respects, the military, and ourselves, to our family and friends, right? Friends. I have more than one friend. So, yeah.
Yeah.
At least got you, and I know some other people, so family and friends.
Is it Trinity, by the way? I think that was
the
test.
It. Did you Google it?
No, it just popped into my head.
Sure,
I got lucky.
Yeah.
I got lucky.
Yeah.
I really like the metaphor of the Manhattan Project and being like the time between Trinity and the bomb is used is kind of like the time between the invention of proof of work and whatever it is we're waiting for, I guess, which is basically the first nation to declare a speculative attack on Bitcoin using their own currency.
Right. That could be it.
So I think, and I do, so as a Bitcoiner, I don't like that term. I don't know what I would call it otherwise, but as a guy who looks at this technology, has more trust and belief in it being what it looks like than anything that I've ever seen. And walking around in a world where 90 some percent of people are completely oblivious, I do think that there may be some really strong correlations there to what the people who worked on the Manhattan Project must have felt in those months. I think it was like 2 months or something.
Yeah, you saw changed world. You saw that the world like was changed immediately. And so,
and you can't go back. And as a as a Bitcoiner, that's what it means, I think, to be orange pilled, which is to like pull back this veil and go, oh, the world that I thought I knew, there is no going back. Like
the strangler pattern is the strangler vine is already too extensively wrapped around our legacy institutions. It's just a matter of how quickly or how disruptive the migration of First Financial than other sorts of digital resources is going to be. Yeah.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to comment, you talked about the financial sector as having, you know, kind of arisen as the power structure within the hierarchy that we have now, basically is where a lot of the actual power is held. And I think about how the comment that I made earlier about how companies became focused on growth and not innovation. So if your company focused on growth, then it's just grow, 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 get bigger, get bigger, get bigger, get more leveraged. It's basically a competition of who can have the most leverage and then apply that leverage. And I just think about how much good to humanity was lost because due to the money that was being paid in that sector, which was due to misallocated capital from poorer signals given to the market, due to that effect, all of these brilliant minds, physics and mathematicians and statisticians, quantitative analysts, all of these people who could have otherwise been working on innovation, things that are beneficial to humanity, instead they went to Wall Street and they developed ways to extract more and more and more and more.
They became priests in an abstract power-based hierarchy.
It's such a waste to think about, because one of the things I think about Elon Musk is that for all of this thoughts that we have about him being, you know, this sort of Tesla-like figure, I think he's far more of a Rockefeller. You know, he's an industrialist. And for everything incredible that they're doing, like with Tesla, they're still iterating on a car. They're still making a faster car, just like the people before wanted a faster horse. And I think a lot of those minds that went to Wall Street, not only did they go to waste really for the loss that we had, but due to the inherent evil nature of the abstract power-based hierarchy at which they sit atop, they themselves became, in effect, evil for the things that they were able to do, the Cantillon effect and extracting so much value for themselves while leaving effectively, you know, scraps for the rest of the world. So,
I don't know. I think Elon is a high priest in the abstract power-based hierarchy that is Diablo 4, and the rest of his enterprises are downstream of that. It's all capital to it.
You got to prioritize.
Some god king has made quite the system for you to be a part of. So,
I want to draw another quick thing that came into mind when I was thinking of this was that this like lines up so the hierarchy thing is that's Jordan Peterson's like bread and butter. Like that's what his books are about.
The acknowledgement of hierarchy is always a revolutionary thing because people want it to be invisible. Power always wants hierarchy to be invisible, so you accept your place within the thing that you don't acknowledge is there. But there's always a dominance hierarchy. There for sure is.
Yeah. And so it's just, you know, I find it fascinating that these common themes pop up across many different domains of interest.
Yeah.
I
think that's for me, like, you know, getting into software, I didn't realize that it was going to go so deep. And I think when any work starts with and takes seriously evolutionary theory and works from that first principle, you're going to arrive at something that is closer to truth than most people are comfortable with, because most of, I think, civilization is about denying that we are animals and denying that we are going to die, denying that if you want anything, you really need to go out and get it, denying all sorts of essential truths that go right down to project power if you want to secure for yourself what we saw we needed to secure back when we were single-celled organisms. So just like beginning first principles again from such a deep perspective and then putting it all together and legitimately through solid argumentation arriving at Bitcoin as a continuation of that very evolutionary war that got us out of the primordial pit, man, the soup, I guess. It's really cool.
So One of the things, again, this Bitcoin, the idea that really got me on the road to Bitcoin, that was like my biggest revelation, was the idea of aligned incentives. And that's, I just, as I go through this, it becomes more and more clear that the selfish act is the selfless act when it comes to Bitcoin. Yeah. Subscribing to the system, subscribing to the network, it gives you power within that network, and it gives the other people power within that network proportionate, and you all are protected from and attack with the same, you're all part of the same army, basically. So everybody who subscribes to that, they benefit from it, which is not something that you've ever seen, because what that looks like in the fiat world is a Ponzi scheme. That's how it's sold, is that everybody that subscribes to this, you benefit from it. But the truth is that eventually, you know, you run out. So, the planetary, I'll kick it back to you, because I want to see where you're taking us now.
So let's get through the recommendations, and then after that we'll move on to general, our own observations and insights about the book, to the extent that they weren't already swept up in what we've already said. So again, the recommendations broken up into two rough categories, containers. The first one is recommendations for future research. The second one is recommendations for future policy making efforts. So, and there's five or seven discrete recommendations. We'll go through them each one by one. So the first recommendation for future research: develop more theories about Bitcoin not based on financial, monetary, or economic theory. And specifically, Lowry recommends other grounded theory approaches to create. Again, what grounded theory does is it doesn't, you know, it isn't the testing of a hypothesis. It's the generation of a theoretical framework from which you're going to derive hypotheses and then test those. So he wants people to, recommendation one, develop more theories about Bitcoin not based in financial, monetary, or economic theory to create alternative frameworks. So Lucas, what do you think about that, Rec?
I think if nothing else comes out of this other than an increase in the amount of research that's done with a grounded theory methodology, it is a huge win, because just the idea of having a previously developed hypothesis that you test because you think that you're asking the right question turns out to be very dangerous, very inefficient, very useless in terms of actually getting a good answer. And so, yeah, I think that's a beautiful recommendation. I don't really know what other angles you come at it from. You've got financial, I guess. You've got the financial, you've got the human kind of humanity side of it. The Alex Gladstein, I don't know how that's quantified.
Yeah,
I'm sure it can be.
Open the university calendar for your nearest university, look at all the disciplines there and say Bitcoin and anthropology,
and chemistry,
biology,
okay,
chemistry, all these things. Mm. What insights? I mean, if Bitcoin seriously is going a strangler pattern vine that is enveloping the architecture of the internet and going to slowly migrate all functionality away from us, what is the cyberspace but in some sense the flowering of all human culture in the digital realm? And so, like, we need to orient to that fact. And I think, there's the possibility, maybe even if the theoretic, you know, the grounded theory, maybe at the end of the day, it's of, not everything is going to be of the same level of impact or insight as coming at it from a financial or a military strategical angle. But I think that each of them would have something to add and something to say, even if to say, you know, that how Bitcoin impacts chemistry is, you know, attenuated in whatever way. But no, I think that all of these disciplines can look at it, and all of them can maybe apportion some insight to the whole endeavor, some new theoretical framework.
Well, it's certainly destroying finance and economics right now. You know, like, it is certainly proving to be something that needs to be examined very deeply.
yeah, yeah.
and not just sailors doing.
Right, right. No, and I mean, so those two, the financial and monetary and economic angles are, there's a lot of awesome people doing really good analysis and things with those orientations. So it's just going to be interesting when we begin to see people doing things with Bitcoin from other academic or theoretical angles. So
yeah. Sailor's rapidly proving that economics doesn't exist and that physics applies everywhere. You know, like he's like, oh, we're just going to take a lever and we're going to spin this thing really fast, and then we're going to smash more Bitcoin into a share. Like,
yeah,
it's interesting. It's because the Bitcoin and could just become Bitcoin obliterates this field. Like completely takes it
this
out.
This was just an artifact of the fiat else. System. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Maybe we'll end up finding out that there's some fields of study that naturally die, or are just absorbed by the approach and the tools of another field.
Yeah. Kind of cool. Yeah. No. And Saylor, the interesting thing about him, I have not listened to some of his things. You know, we all kind of touch on some of his longer lectures, I think, and hear him go really deep into the nature of power. And Lowry also cites him a few times with the cyber hornets protecting yada yada and all these things. And so Saylor has a really, of course, deep philosophical understanding that goes far beyond finance, monetary, and economic theory. And I think that it would be interesting if he did some general Saylorian theory of reality. Recommendation two, deductively analyze Bitcoin from the perspective of power projection theory. So again, Lowry did a grounded theory analysis. He did come up with a theoretical framework. That theoretical framework is power projection theory. So we can also begin to analyze Bitcoin from the theory that he has generated. And so we can derive some new hypotheses from the theoretical framework that he has generated and test those. Some that he says have some hypotheses that could be tested based on his power projection theory that have been generated in the context of this thesis. Can physical cost function protocols, proof of work, such as in Bitcoin, represent the operating system of a completely new type of planetary scale computer? That's a hypothesis we could test. If so, would it have completely new emergent properties? If so, what are the benefits of reverse optimized planetary scale computer that makes bits expensive? So these are hypotheses that kind of Lowry, as he's developed his power projection theory, has deduced. The rec two then is deductively analyze Bitcoin from the perspective of power projection theory, including possibly these hypotheses. What do you think?
I think we've got a guy who is saying, here's my research. Go ahead and try to break it. Do whatever you can. Test it in every which way. I think that's a sign of a good researcher, which is somebody that is open to being challenged on their conclusions. So yeah.
I mean, that's, you said, yeah. I was open last time that the idea of a planetary scale computer, a state mechanism that is the world, was eluding my comprehension in some fundamental way. For me, a computer is a magic box that kind of shows you things when you type words into it. I lack the computer science theoretical framework. It's been very illuminating, and I encourage anybody else who wants to understand more about object-oriented programming, what programming even is. I think this thesis is a great place to start, but it does arrive at this very high-level concept of a planetary scale computer. Did you want to make a run at the impenetrable wall that is my ignorance on this, or do you think that we leave that be and try to scoop it up later? Because if you want to cure my ignorance,
I don't think I have the best grip on it yet either,
but yeah.
The way that I'm trying to think of it would be that the abstract power-based hierarchy it's sitting at the top. That's like the layer four. So like when you think of Bitcoin, they talk, you know, L1, L2, L3, L4. So it's like it's top-down design where you basically say, we want to tell this story so that we're in charge. And so what's the type of power that we need in order to enforce that? And it turns out the best form of power to enforce that is a fiat monetary system. because that allows you to create unlimited power, which is merely stealing the energy and life force of your citizens from the future and bringing it into the present. So I think it's interesting because you've got this, so it's a top-down approach. We're coming at it from the perspective of we're a power-based hierarchy. We want to stay in power. What is the L1 that best supports that? And so you reverse engineer this thing for speed, as opposed to bottom engineer it up for security, which is what Bitcoin. So Bitcoin, then it's your L1, and you build upon that so that as you go up the layer, you maintain the security and you add speed and you add functionality, but you don't start with the functionality and say, this is how we're going to design the feeding mechanism in order to steal resources in order to make it run, because it's like the comparison to airplane design, which is that like any failure is a catastrophic failure. Like it has to be designed to be perfect first, perfectly safe, and then we'll make it go fast. So anyway, it's just the idea of Bitcoin as a planetary computer. I guess really what I was thinking was, okay, so what does it look like if you have a perfectly secure L1? What does the power-based hierarchy look like on top of that? And I think that power-based hierarchy is it's a dictator, but it's a decentralized AI dictator. And that decentralized AI dictator enforce. So the problem with the abstract power-based hierarchies is that they're not immutable, is that they change the laws, the rules in order to benefit them. So that would be a way to use the immutability of Bitcoin to tie it to an AI so that it applies the beautiful.
But what is a planet? Is the computer a planet? Is the planet a computer if Bitcoin uses the world's infrastructure to derive power to compute hash functions, which then solve, add a block and maintain a ledger? It seems like the actual computing is done by computers, and they're merely being like fed energy in the same way that you plug a computer in. They, of course, take energy and they use that to complete the hashing functions. But the actual, a computer is a thing that computes. What is being computed is there's different distinct computing functions that are going on maybe, but it seems like I don't understand how the infrastructure can be a motherboard, or we can say that the world is a computer, except for in a very metaphorical sense, where computer is beginning to take on a distinct meaning from my understanding of a computer. I don't know, but that's, I don't know that we're going to solve that.
Maybe the world's energy system is the power supply of the computer, and the ASICs, the ASICs are the processor, and the blockchain is the memory card.
I think, yeah. And so in that sense, you can say computer, it's, maybe that's, if it's that sense, okay, that makes sense. But it sounded to me like the planet was a computer in some sense, in that the infrastructure is like the circuit. Like the circuit, of course, runs across the face of the chip, and like the world is a chip, a macro chip. And I don't fully understand that. We have a hypothesis here. I want somebody to flesh out the terms and then try to find a way to test it, even if in theoretical space or whatever. So
I think it's because the higher layers haven't been developed yet. So I think that when you see those higher layers get developed, like smart contracts and AI dictators on there, then I think it might be easier to see, but who knows?
Yeah. I think that computer science itself is a series of metaphors about what is happening to changes of state of a mechanism, and that Lowry's theory, of course, uses computer science as foundational, and so draws from that school of metaphors. I just want a Bitcoin and that removes computers from the equations and describes it to me with crowns on an Indian big red pad so that I can understand it.
Yeah.
So
and I want to I want to hear a good answer on the quantum computer question, because if Bitcoin is a state changing machine and then you have a computer that can exist in both states at once, how does that change the game? I heard Michael Saylor try to answer the question one time, and I wasn't like fully, I didn't understand what he said. So who knows?
So that might actually, that thoughts about quantum computing and similar might fall into the next. We've finished up recommendations for future research. Now we're on to recommendations for future policymaking efforts. Maybe quantum computing, considering the role that that might play, would be one of those. But in any case, recommendation three, a recommendation for a future policymaking effort, similar to recommendation one, don't rely on financial, monetary, or economic and or economic theorists to influence Bitcoin policy. I think it's don't rely solely on, maybe. Is the meaning of that. Don't rely on financial, monetary, economic theorists to influence Bitcoin policy.
Just and he has really good... Don't listen to Peter Schiff is what it says.
Well, that's his own rule. That's
policy recommendations.
Yeah.
Right. Jim Cramer cannot have a rule.
Yeah. No, we could just set him up and have him say the opposite of what we want, like a reverse Pythia that just like predicts the opposite future of what we want, and then it becomes reality. So,
I don't know what world that guy lives in.
An inverse oracle, and we just have him say the things that we don't want to come about or whatever, the opposite. Yeah.
Like a dead weatherman gets stuff right more often.
We can harness Cramer's power if we know how to use it. We have to. It's like a very Greek tragedy, the way we have to ask these questions of him.
Go on.
But you said weatherman, though.
I said dead weatherman.
So let's talk about living weathermen. Weathermen
Ron Burgundy.
Are not... A good analogy or metaphor for why we shouldn't rely on financial monetary economic theorists solely to influence Bitcoin policy. We don't call in weathermen to talk about what quote unquote cloud computing is, right? And so Lowry's thought is we're misunderstanding Bitcoin as money, and that's causing us to call in financial monetary economic theorists in the same way that Amazon Web Service call in like an etymologist to talk about spiders because they have a web. It's like, no, you don't do that. I gotta realize that these are metaphors we're using. Bitcoin is a metaphor, so don't rely solely on financial people. So I guess, what do you think about that? Don't rely on financial, monetary, economic theorists to influence Bitcoin policy.
Yeah, that sounds like a really solid recommendation.
Do you think that, or go ahead.
I was just gonna say the thing about not recognizing it as a weapon or as a power projection technology because it's purported as a money, the bonus is that if you buy the money story, then you're supporting the weapon story anyways. So you're already doing your role.
But
he does, and I don't know, I'm not following along exactly. So is it, I don't know if it's this point or later on, but we're domesticated and we're not versed in computer science. And that means that we are doubly screwed at being able to recognize this for what it is. And not only that, so one of the things about being a Bitcoiner is that you become more in tune to the world around you. You become more in tune with, you know, theories about nature. You become more in tune with nature. Everybody's outside getting their grunt on. On the flip side is that abstract power-based hierarchies, they seem to encourage, instead of being present, distracted. And so not only are we domesticated, not only are we not versed in computer science, it is of the power-based hierarchy's benefit to constantly distract us from being in a position where we could recognize that, because there are so many weathermen reporting on cloud servers type of thing. Like that's what your financial services television is basically. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I'm along with that.
I think, that's a good one. Recommendation four, think of Bitcoin as, this is a recommendation for a future policymaker. Think of Bitcoin as electro cyber security system rather than a monetary system. So similar to the last one, but an affirmation, a positive statement. Think of Bitcoin as an electro cyber security system. So basically, cyberspace is the new realm of warfare. Bitcoin is the security force of that system of cyberspace, of that realm. Within this recommendation to think of Bitcoin as electro cyber security system, he mentions two, maybe three things we might want to do. consider stockpiling Bitcoin, consider supporting a robust domestic hashing industry, and perhaps, he says, even dedicate military resources to defending mass-based infrastructure, the physical aspect of the Bitcoin network. Internet, the thing, the physical correlate to the internet, the power grid, computational facilities, the chip fab aspect of that. So what do you think about that? Thinking of Bitcoin as an electro cybersecurity system and potentially doing those things.
I think the name is so cool that nobody will ever get it. I think they want it to be really boring. Like if you're trying to sell a senator on something.
Well, what name?
The electro cyber security system. It just sounds too cool. Where I don't know if it can get traction with Congress. It needs its own MAGA. I was thinking about this. Like Donald Trump doesn't win the presidency without that ugly red hat. Like that thing became ubiquitous and it spread the ideology. It spread the belief or whatever. Soft war needs a ugly ass red MAGA hat. It's just like bold, but it needs that memification in order to be grasped by someone who hears electro cybersecurity whatever and they go blah, 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 you know, like that. And again, as a result of the inherent nature of an abstract power-based hierarchy to use its power to distract its citizens, that's where we've gone as a culture, is that we are not deeply thinking about things. We are looking for the meme, which is okay if you can develop the meme.
That's a good recommendation. He actually, in the 7 recommendations he has, doesn't have consider how best to memetically infuse Bitcoin as bit power into a thing that's going to educate the public about this. I mean, this is a recommendation for a policymaker could be consider the rhetorical angle. How rhetorically should Bitcoin be framed and sold to the democratic populace whose support you want to further these other policies?
He needs to have a meme competition.
I mean, there's so many good ones. Like soft war, of course, is itself soft war. That's an excellent phrase. The electro cyber security dome. I mean, there's all things in here. The antlers thing. These are all really good educational tools that Lowry has. The problem is that the thesis itself is so, there's so many interlocking parts. It's like how rhetorically you say Bitcoin is warfare and people recoil from that. And you're like, no. Bitcoin is the soft war protocol that makes warfare as you know it obsolete in a certain sense. That like antlers helping deer resolve their dominance disputes, and then you're already, the person's eyes have glazed. So like, how do you educate the populace? Do you just say Bitcoin is money and then just go on with your policies regardless? Maybe that's the best way. Because recommendation 5, consider supporting Bitcoin under the Second Amendment, proof of work protected under the Second Amendment. What do you think about that?
1,000%. I absolutely see how Bitcoin as a monetary instrument, it kills fiat, which is what allows for wars to occur, or at least at the scale that we see them. But not only does it do that, Bitcoin itself is both the battlefield, and it's the weapon, and it's the defense against the weapon, and it's the resource over which you're competing. So it's everything. It takes all of that stuff and it packs it into one nice little container where it's not, everything is so disjointed. I heard that Trump is selling Bitcoin to people by saying it's digital gold, and gold is energy extracted from the ground, but it's not useful typically where it's extracted. You have to take it somewhere. If you have to take it somewhere, you have to protect the trade routes. If you have to protect the trade routes, you're going to get into skirmishes. Bitcoin, you're drawing energy out of the ground, and you can use it right there, or you can use it wherever you are in the entire world. So you can take energy out of the ground in Antarctica, and it can be used in Buenos Aires immediately, with no transportation cost, without having to inflict kinetic energy upon someone in order to protect that route, without loss of expended energy in order to just physically get it there.
How does that get us to the Second Amendment, though?
So it's the battle. It's like I said, it is everything. It's the cannon. It's the cannonball. It's the black powder. And cyberspace is the battlefield. So
yeah. It
is all those things.
I mean, it's all these things as a very poetic description. But of course, the Second Amendment, there's a jurisprudence associated. There's the way that the Supreme Court has interpreted the right to bear arms. And so, you know, it's not the right to bear a battlefield. And so, like, you know, as a proposal, consider supporting Bitcoin under the Second Amendment. I guess that has to be a proposal that we rhetorically begin to kind of, we seed the thought into the consciousness that hopefully is going to arrive at judges that Bitcoin is an arm that we have the right to bear. And yeah. So it
means classifying it as a weapon.
Right. Yeah, right. There we go.
Yeah,
yeah. Like, the government could.
Yeah. Which, because it's you know, you have the right to bear arms to protect your property, basically, to protect your freedom.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's right. The government could do it regulatorily, classify as a weapon, which would do something for the Supreme Court or some circuit judge in interpreting it as something a person might have a right to.
Well, so Bitcoin is already defined as property by the SEC, I believe,
or maybe
the IRS. I can't remember. But anyways, so it's already defined as property. So now I think the only barrier that you have to hop is you're like, okay, for the Second Amendment gives you the right to bear arms to protect your property. So here's it requires a grounded theory methodology because you have to go backwards. You have to go, okay, here's the property. How do you defend it? Well, the property is how you defend it. So
the proof of work aspect of it.
Yeah.
So that's slicing off the proof of work aspect to be protect Bitcoin under the Second Amendment. You protect
proof of work.
Proof of work. Right. Yeah.
Ooh,
right on.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So
okay.
That's kind of more of a refined approach even. Proof
cool.
of work, not even Bitcoin. Cool.
There's a few podcasts where Lowry really gets into this with a couple podcasters about, is it First Amendment, Second Amendment? So there is an underlying issue. I mean, like, there is what is the best strategy to protect the common person's access to this thing that if you classify it as a weapon, a munition, is this going to, you know, jeopardize the ability of the common person to self-custody or something like that? There's a whole debate there. I guess I'm kind of agnostic on it, but it makes sense that it would be under the second amendment. So,
well, yeah. Bitcoin is code. So there's case law supporting, the code being protected under free speech. So the entire thing gets protected under free speech. But then, maybe proof of work itself is explicitly protected under the Second Amendment.
Yeah,
I like it.
Cool, it's a possibility.
I think you should argue for it.
Oh, there we go. I'll do it. Recommendation six.
Go ahead.
No, okay. Recommendation six. Recognize that proof of stake is not a viable replacement for proof of work. And he mentions, so when he does this, I mean, obviously Ethereum is kind of what's in the mind's eye here. Recognize proof of stake is not a viable replacement for proof of work. He says something interesting in talking about this, that he says that Ethereum is a Sybil attack in operation. A Sybil attack is when you use fake identities to gain a majority of a network to then exploit that network. And he just, my reading of it is that he's saying proof of stake just is already a Sybil attack, and that there's potentially fake identities, pseudonymous identities, or anonymous people who control these things. You have no way to verify who owns, you know, this stuff. A lot of it was granted by, as I understand it, the Ethereum Foundation granted a lot of people Ethereum when it was proof of work, and then it converts over to proof of stake, and we don't actually know who are the majority owners of all this. So that's one part of it. And he just casually mentions too that it's run by non-US citizens, and so that might give one pause. So recognize proof of stake is not a viable replacement for proof of work. I assume you're on board with this, Lucas.
Yeah, you know, I hate proof of work. I think it's like
stake. Yeah. You hate proof of stake.
Sorry,
I suppose.
Proof of stake. My bad. I love proof of work. The Sybil attack. So remember when we talked about, I was saying like your book is not something you own. It's something that you have until someone takes away from you. And because somebody has more power than you. So it's not, if it can be taken away from you, then you don't own it. You can only own something that you can only lose by giving away or by literally losing, in my mind. And so, yeah, proof of stake is utter trash. It's the hole in the fence of the pasture. It is not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, that something that what you have will be taken from you without your permission.
Right on. Yeah. Recommendation 7. This is the last of the recommendation 7 for future policymaking efforts. Don't expect the next war to look like the last war. Lowry has went through the history of what results when that happens, of thinking that they're going to come at us with this technology and not this new technology. They're not going to use cannons against us because they didn't use cannons against us in the last war. And so you make yourself vulnerable to cannons. So, yeah.
Yeah. I think that's just the fun part of his job, which is that you get to look at all of these wars in succession and then kind of apply the same principle to nature as well and look at all of the hierarchies in nature. But I mean, the really cool thing is like, hey, weapons are cool. Like they're fun to look at. And so you get it like, oh, here's a cool sword. And then here's that sword that no longer is useful because this guy has a musket ball. And then the musket ball is no longer useful because the guy has a rifled shell and then a machine gun and then an airplane. Like it's just, I think it's kind of cool. And I love the chart that he put up where it's like the progression of the weapons. As they go up, they gain in power projection. And then he's got this offshoot with the drone technology.
I
think drone technology is fascinating because it's doing this. It's going the opposite way. Instead of going up in the amount of power projected, it's going down. And like the most efficient drone is going to be like a little bumblebee that stings you and kills you.
Yeah, but that's still – so that chart is – power projection techniques are becoming more and more dangerous, more and more kinetically powerful until they go past a kinetic ceiling where they become impractical to use. So that arc upward with strategic nuclear weapons has broken through that ceiling of practicality. It's no longer practical. If we attempt, and so one might think we can no longer engage in large-scale warfare with a nuclear armed party. How about these small proxy wars, these small kinetic warfares, what's happened in Ukraine, something like that, where traditional forces do meet, even as larger powers withhold the use of their nuclear arms. But Lowry says we're going to see a fork away from nuclear arms in these smaller conflicts towards something perhaps like AI-powered drones. The point is that even these small-scale conflicts are going to become kinetically more and more devastating. The killing machine is not going to stop innovating and finding better ways to kill, whether that's, like you said, the bee sting drone or like drones with grenades attached to them and there's just millions of them and they're operated by some AI and so perfectly, like some ballet in the air that with pinpoint precision can go and kill any person they set out after. Maybe it's an engineered virus that attacks the DNA of the ethnic group you don't like. Like any kinetic offshoot to try to go around the stalemate that nuclear arms poses is itself going to arrive at a kinetic stalemate where it's impractical to use it because it's going to mutually assure destruction. I got a question for you.
Boom.
Don't expect the next war to look like the last. Yeah. Oftentimes, science fiction is a good way for us to imagine the future while we sit in a chair and enjoy entertainment. What is the sci-fi movie, piece of literature, whatever, that helps us to understand something like Bitcoin as a form of warfare, as a protective electro-cyber dome within cyberspace, as a portal between the virtual and the real? there's a few times the Matrix was mentioned by Lowry. It's useful, but not perfect. My realm of reference is not great. What is the sci-fi movie or literature that's going to help us and other people, or is it yet to be made by some enterprising artist that is going to help us understand a software protocol?
I think it's Tron. Have you seen Tron?
Long time ago. What's the angle there?
So what is proof of work? Proof of work is a race. It's a race to beat everybody else to the destination. And there's real world implications in terms of physical power. And in Tron, if I remember right, it's like a motorcycle race or a Tron whatever thing race in cyberspace, but with real world consequences. Like if you die there,
nice.
You die.
Yeah.
Right.
Cool. Yeah.
It's a race just like proof of work. So I think that would be, I've been trying to think about this too, because so many future type technology stuff, they always have some sort of like archaic steampunky type of thing going on where you just know, looking at it, you're like, no, they're not going to use swords. Like, no.
Yeah.
Like, you know, no, they're not going to have elephants with lasers on them, you know?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I think Tron does a good idea, does a good job.
You know, so this originates, a lot of this theorizing, in Tesla's observation that human out-of-the-loop electric warfare is going to replace kinetic warfare. So this has been... human out-of-the-loop warfare has been a thing in the consciousness for a long, long time. I wonder, is there a sci-fi or piece, is there something that does already have human out-of-the-loop warfare? I read Ender's Game once. I don't remember what it's about, but I think perhaps, if I recall correctly, and I don't, it was about that. But some enterprising person could read that book and tell me, or look at the Wikipedia, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know of any human out-of-the-loop ones that I'm sure they exist. I've never really been into too much sci-fi. I do like some good ones. But yeah, the only ones I can think of are like where they're fighting with robots and stuff, but they're like inside the robots. They're not remote controlling them or anything.
Right.
So
Yeah.
I don't know about that one. That's a great question.
And it's this Bitcoin and thing, like Bitcoin and pop culture, like, right now, if someone did a survey of Bitcoin and pop culture, they would see a very niche culture, perhaps in X, formerly Twitter, of people doing certain Bitcoin-related art-type things. But otherwise, it would be like, oh, Bitcoin was mentioned casually in this movie or something like that. There's not yet like something where Bitcoin is integral to it within the pop culture, either musically or...
Yeah.
In an artistic fashion, or movies, or a series where like Bitcoin is the thing that is the plot element or provides the structure of the entertainment. I think that is going to happen. And it's going to be interesting to see what is the Bitcoin influenced art that emerges, and that influence being like really integral to what the work of art means and kind of the structure of it, not just like, oh, we'll accept Bitcoin for the art or something like that. Or, oh, we use Bitcoin in this movie. No, like something where it is definitive of what that piece of art means within the context of human culture.
There's a TV show, the guy who played Freddie Mercury in the Queen movie, where he's like in this very near-term future where it's like evil corporation is like literally everything that we're seeing happen now was happening. And in the big... Bitcoin was like the very prominent, like the central bank digital currency that the evil bank put out was like a very prominent, it played a very prominent role. I think, it's called Mr. Robot. It's called Mr. Robot.
Oh, okay. That, heard of it, not seen it.
Yeah, that's well worth it. That would be well worth it because it's almost like a step play by play. The focus, the storyline is maybe a little more focused on the psychological nature of this guy, I guess, kind of. But the core principles of like the banks are failing, the corporations are evil, they're pushing central bank digital currencies. Bitcoin is way that you resist it. Yeah, it's like that'd be a really good one. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Anything where a work of art, a story or something like that acknowledges money as a form of surveillance or control would be an antecedent to like Bitcoin as art, or like within the tradition of like, here's something that augured the arrival of Bitcoin. So for sure, like that's really, that'd be cool.
And he's got movies on his, reading through the credits or whatever the citations, like Prometheus, the movie, right. Any Given Sunday is in there. Like, mm-hmm. The Great Gatsby, like this is cool. Like he drew a lot of pop culture stuff. And so, I think if we're going to continue to think about this, this idea, then looking for inspiration in art is a really good idea.
For sure. And for all the artists out there, give us that inspiration. Like, what can you do to, like, what does Bitcoin mean to you at like a really deep psychological level where psychology hits emotion for you and makes you feel something? And then how can you channel that into something that's not like Bitcoin slop or something like that? So I want to see that. I want to feel that. I want that to exist.
Yeah. That would be nice in my world.
Yeah. So feeling something in my world too, man, just feeling anything. That's all the recommendations. So
anything would be nice.
That is, oh man, Bitcoin is hope one day. So recommendation, we went through all seven of them. That concludes chapter 6 as far as like we summarized it, we talked about it, we did the recommendations. That brings us to kind of like a retrospective teary-eyed of the thesis in general. And if you had anything, I guess, that you wanted to say about it, any remaining insights, anything at all?
I think the idea is like cotton candy for the brain. It's just so much fun. It's just the reason why you and I decided to have this conversation was because we both started reading this and we were like, this is fascinating. Like, this is really cool. It's a fun thing to think about and have a discussion on. I really enjoyed, I don't know, like favorite takeaways. It's funny. I think my favorite takeaway is not something that I actually had to do with research. It was just this idea of the grounded theory methodology. Like that truly is a better way to answer questions. And so I really am going to be viewing things so much differently. And I guess I would assume that grounded theory methodology is just like another way of saying first principles thinking, but, it's just you're like, look, it's like watching someone who's a professional wire up something after you've struggled to try and like put the stuff in the right spot. Like it's like, oh, okay, maybe there's like more to this than just here to there. Maybe there's a whole lot in between that we should consider. So what about you?
Whenever somebody can, you have an object in your hand and you're staring at it and you're like, I've exhausted my experience of this object. I perfectly understand everything this object has to offer. And then that person picks it up and rotates it in your hand. And you're like, there's a whole new angle on this thing.
I know nothing.
It's like, So all objects like recede from our ultimate understanding. And so anybody that can take and unpack a new aspect of any phenomena. And again, like this, that's what was an entry point for us. I mean, like our whole project is like, what are the great books of Bitcoin? Because Bitcoin is a much bigger phenomena than merely like trading or something like that. Than something, it's going to transform in a strangler vine pattern many aspects of our lives. And so, what is the canon of literature that's going to help us understand this in all of its fullness, which is going to include and does include financial and monetary and economic thinkers, but it also includes other things. And that's what is fascinating about this is unapologetically looking at something called Bitcoin from a non-coin related angle of military theory. And so like that's liberating. I hope it's liberating for anybody listening, reading or whatever, that you too can think about Bitcoin from whatever perspective you bring in your own life, like in your profession, anything like that. And it's going to add something. And not only can you bring your own perspective, but you can open yourself up to the fact that other people are trying to bring their perspectives and share them. And like, we can read, we can think about these ideas, and it's really going to enrich our understanding of this phenomena that, again, I mean, if it is what I think many of us think it is, it really is going to have some sort of transformatory impact on many aspects of our lives beyond merely as a savings technology or whatever.
Yeah. My favorite, I think my favorite part of our discussions today was when you brought up the comparison to the time frame of people who were living and had the knowledge of the Manhattan Project after Trinity, before the world knew about it. And I think that that is such a wonderful way to put what most people who are at this level, and even not even near this level, but just like believers in Bitcoin, I think are walking around in that, the, you know, that same mode where it's like the world is about to be changed and no one knows it and I know it and I can't do anything about it. And so, you know, you just, I guess, do what you can. But
that's
yeah. I made the comment, by the way, earlier about how I think it's such a tragedy that all of these brilliant minds that were like physics, engineers, statisticians, mathematicians, that their talents went to waste and were used to abuse society through the faults of the power hierarchy in the financial services industry. I also think about, so those physicists would have become physicists, not financial analysts, and the mathematicians would have been mathematicians, not quants, and they would have done real good for the world. And I thought about another parallel, which was that, so in order to enforce that power-based hierarchy, you have to have a legal system that is just massive. And so then you get a lot of brilliant minds that are going into law because there's, in some places, opportunity for a lot of money there. And in the same way, I think about like, what would the physicists have done if they hadn't gone to Wall Street? I think about what would the lawyers have done if they hadn't gone to DC? And I think a lot of them would have become philosophers. And I think we may be entering an era where that's one of the things, is that maybe what you and I are doing is just a natural outcropping of this, where, yeah, you know, like you're a lawyer who is now effectively a philosopher right now. So, you know, I mean, you always have been
at this point.
Yeah, you always have been, but it's just it's more of an expression of your true nature, I think. So
yeah perhaps.
So I wonder how that applies to like brilliant minds that were misallocated to other fields as well, and like what they would be doing, you know.
There's going to be vast disruption, and everybody in their own life. I mean, if, as Lowry says, like, the term national defense is now going to change because national is going to change. I mean, we all define ourselves in relation to our membership in a nation state, in relation to how state power interacts with our daily lives. Like, these are aspects, whether we are consciously aware of it or not, of that I think constitutive of our identity. Certainly, as you point out, constitutive or contributory or determinative of how we use our time, to what we dedicate, what vocations we dedicate our lives, what are the vocations to which one can dedicate themselves. When the nature of the polity, the nation state, changes, is disrupted by a technology that decentralizes key aspects of what the government used to do, I mean, it's like the new Doge office in the form of a protocol. It's eating things away, I mean, just in a sort of natural way. What does that mean for each of us individually? As you mentioned, maybe it shifts a lot of people into more productive endeavors or
fulfilling.
I think that's a really good way to put it. Like, what does it mean to be human? And maybe Bitcoin allows us to ask ourselves that on a much more frequent basis, because that's the project. If you don't have to worry about, how am I going to save my value? How am I going to protect myself from the wolves in the abstract power-based hierarchy, the people above me exploiting me? What do I got to do to protect myself and the ones I love? if you can free up a lot of that time, maybe you can rededicate it to exploring your humanity through whatever, you know, project is much more fulfilling. Yeah.
I think we're seeing that authenticity is the most marketable skill, the ability to be authentic and to genuinely try to connect, because what we're seeing is the realization of Kevin Kelly's 1,000 true fans, where anybody who is genuinely doing something out of love and putting work into it and trying to answer the question of what is my purpose by answering it with to have a purpose and to have a purpose that I can dedicate myself to.
Yeah.
I mean, just because you're seeing like this creator economy is utterly exploding. And so, yeah, I think that's where it comes down, is that you just have people who realize that they do have a calling. Like, it's whether you call it spiritual or just sort of a recognition that you are meant to do something extraordinary in the way that it's extraordinary for the type of purpose and fulfillment that you'll have from it. I think that's where it moves us. I think that's the direction it takes us, because we're able to, you know, carry wealth further into the future without having to continuously, you know, fight growth, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. As Sailor says, you spend 40,000 hours working. Why not spend 100 hours figuring out how to preserve the value that you make from that work? And what happens when you do put in those hours and the technology arrives that allows you to save those? Maybe that 40,000 ticks way down, and these projects of authenticity, even unmarketable authenticity, maybe those become much more forefront in people's minds. So yeah, I hope so. But that's, I don't know. That's what I have to say, I think, about soft war for the time being. What do you think?
Soft war needs a MAGA hat.
There we go. Yeah.
Yeah. That's
it. Have
at. Yeah. And that's it. Yep. I'm good. You guys, thanks for giving us reason to continue doing these. It's been a lot of fun, and excited to see where it goes next. You can follow Grant on X at The Whole Frame. You can follow me at Lucas Matty. The podcast will be up on YouTube and Spotify and X. So
cool. Thanks, man. Awesome convo.